This is Our Voices. I'm Mario Trimble. In order to be a place where everyone in our community feels valued and connected, we first have to ensure everyone believes they belong. Our Voices is a joint podcast production from the Colorado and Denver Bar Association's Equity, Diversity, and Inclusivity Joint Steering Committee. Our Voices shines a light on the unique stories, experiences, and backgrounds of our member leaders so that we can help each other walk together. Judge Diana Terry of the Colorado Court of Appeals has always prioritized service to the legal community and the community at large. Her attention to detail and instructional nature have made a lasting impact on the court, and her contributions in and out of the courtroom were recognized by the Colorado Women's Bar Association when she received the 2013 CWBA Judicial Excellence Award. Additionally, Judge Terry's leadership experience includes being past president of both the Thompson G. Marsh American Inn of Court and the Law Club of Denver, as well as a past president of the Board of Trustees for Metro Care Ring, a faith-based nonprofit food pantry. Judge Terry is a woman of many talents. These include singing, educating, and leading. And she also has a knack of folding clothes perfectly. Judge Terry shares her path to the Court of Appeals from commercial litigation and her stops along the way with Nicole Sparaza and Courtney Hull.
We are so fortunate today to have recently retired Court of Appeals Judge Diana Terry with us. And I am Courtney Holm. I am an attorney and mediator in Edwards, Colorado, serving mountain client needs. And I have a co-host today.
Hi, my name is Nicole Sparaza. I am a solo practitioner in the Denver metro area, practicing family law and civil litigation.
Judge Terry, we are so pleased that you've taken the time to come and speak with us today. And so our podcast speaks a little bit about your personal life. So much of your life has been devoted to public service and writing opinions, and we want to know more about you as a person and your history and your past. And so we're going to ask you who you were, who you are, and who you're going to be. And so let's start with who you were. What was it like growing up as mini Judge Diana Terry?
Well, The judge piece was certainly not predetermined. The lawyer piece was not predetermined. There were no lawyers in my family. And I think until his dying day, which was just a few years ago, my father was very surprised that I'd become a lawyer. But I got a passion for law and helping people in the 70s when I was a kid. I had two older sisters who were kind of powerful women in their own right, and my grandmother had been a suffragette, and my mother was a very strong person. She was an army wife with five kids, and my father was away in World War II, and then later he went away and after the Korean conflict was over, he was in Korea. So she raised for a lot of the time five kids by herself.
What did your grandmother do for the suffragette movement?
My family were Nebraskans, and my grandmother lived in town in a very rural area, and she and other women that she knew were involved in the League of Women Voters, trying to get the vote for women, and she really instilled in my mother a service aspect and a desire for women to be seen as equals, peers. I, you know, was the fifth of five kids. I was the youngest by a lot, and I just became this kind of, not a loner, but sort of my own person early on. And I read when I was pretty young a biography about Clarence Darrow, and I thought, I want to be a lawyer. And there were a couple of TV shows on at that time that in fact actually showed women as lawyers. It was a really brand new thing. And so that's what I decided I wanted to do. And I was really fortunate that I entered Rutgers University at a time after Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who at that time was on the faculty at Rutgers Law School, she told the university that they had to admit women to their flagship school, which was Rutgers College. they had not admitted women before 1975. And so I was in the third class of women to graduate from Rutgers College. And there was a tremendous women's school called Douglas College that was part of Rutgers University, and my sister graduated from there. And in fact, one of my law school classmates also graduated from there, and she went on to be editor-in-chief of the Law Review and then chief bankruptcy judge out in the Central District of California. But so it was a great school, but I was able to have the kinds of privileges that somebody who went to the flagship school had.
I have a couple of questions about when you were growing up, because you mentioned that you were the youngest by a lot. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
My nearest sibling is 6 years older. And so I spent a lot of time at home by myself. And I was kind of a loner as a kid in a way until I discovered music and drama. And then I found my people.
And it sounds like you were always surrounded by pretty strong women. When you talk about your grandmother, you talk about your mother, you mentioned that two of your older sisters, I believe, were wonderful women. Mm-hmm. What was that like for you? Did that add a lot of pressure to you when you were growing up? Or I know that you said that you were pretty independent as well. How did that influence and shape you while you were growing up?
It didn't put pressure on me at all. I am the kind of person who puts pressure on myself. And I'm a self-starter. So, you know, the legal profession was kind of a sensible thing for me to do, although I didn't do it right away. I didn't have the money to go to law school after college. I took the very highly sought out job of assistant manager for the Gap for 2 years.
Mm. You fell into the Gap.
I fell into the Gap.
How long were you in the Gap?
I was in the Gap for a very long time because I started working there when I was in high school and all the way through college. And so I was an assistant manager for about a year and a half. And then I quit and studied for the LSAT.
So what made you want to go to law school? Was it coming from this family that sounds like you have a lot of strong women in it? And I want to know a little bit more about your grandmother as well. But was that something that ignited a passion for you to go into the law?
Partly. I mean, I certainly had a feeling that people deserve justice and people deserve rights. And I saw people that weren't treated very well. Just sort of generically, as I was growing up, it was the middle of the civil rights movement, and I was pretty aware of what was going on. The Vietnam War was going on, and a lot of protest sort of activity was going on. So I just was aware of a lot of things, and more than some of my peers because I had older siblings and really talked to them about what was going on. My dad was also a newspaper reporter and a magazine editor, and so we were pretty up to speed on what was going on in the world.
Was he a magazine editor after his service that you mentioned?
Yes. So he, after World War II, he landed on Omaha Beach in World War II 3 days after D-Day. But he was building, he was the head of a company that built and repaired bridges and roads, so he didn't have to shoot at anyone, and he only got shot at a few times. But anyway, after World War II, he got his journalism degree, and was able to go to the University of Missouri, which is considered the top journalism school in the U.S., I think, still. And he was an extremely smart man, and he was a great writer. I wish I could write as well as he does. I always aspire to that.
Tell me a little bit about law school. What was your law school experience like?
I had a great law school experience. I had terrific classmates. I am still really close friends with my study group from law school. We had a 25th anniversary get-together where we rented a house in Kennebunkport, Maine. And then for our 35th anniversary, we rented a house in Taos. And honestly, those people I still get along so amazingly well with. They're very accomplished, and everybody's done something that's service-oriented.
So you mentioned besides falling into the Gap, you also fell in love with music and some other things. What are those other activities that you really, really got interested in and made an impact on you and maybe you still do today?
I was one of those drama kids. It was in the drama club in school and in the chorus, and that really helped me. And I, back in, after I came to Denver and was practicing law here, in about 1988, I discovered the law club, and they were recruiting people to sing and act and dance in a law club show, and I found my people big time.
And Judge Terry, for those who don't know, can you just describe, what is the law club?
The law club, well, it was formed in 1914, and it was supposed to be the something like 20 best young lawyers in Denver, and it was, of course, all men until the 1970s. Boy, it was a big deal when they added women. And I want to say, I think it was 1979 that they added women. Anyway, back in the days when there was still a bar convention, every other year, the law club would put together a satirical show, music and skits and dancing and carrying on, and we'd perform that at the bar convention. Well, the bar convention went away several years ago, and we kind of lost our venue. But then someone came up with the great idea that we should do the ethics review, where people can get ethics credits for watching a funny show. And we have tremendous singers and dancers and actors in the law club. We have actually one or two people who've done it at least semi-professionally. I'm not one of them, but we really have some great talents. And so I've really had fun doing that over the years. I've written many, many, many songs and skits for the law club, and I've directed a lot of shows because I'm a very bossy person.
I am also sometimes a bossy person, so I'm going to see if I can get you to sing something.
Well, what I am prepared to sing is not one of my favorites from the law club, but I sort of warmed up on it this morning. The song that came to mind is a James Taylor song that I just love.
There is a young cowboy who lives on the range. His horse and his cattle are his only companions. He works in the saddle and he sleeps in the canyons, waiting for summer, his pastures to change. And as the moon rises, he sits by his fire, thinking about women and glasses of beer. Closes his eyes as the dogies retire. He sings out a song which is soft but it's clear, as if maybe someone could hear. Good night, you moonlight ladies. Rock-a-bye, sweet baby James. Deep greens and blues are the colors I choose. Won't you let me go down in my dreams and rock-a-bye, sweet baby James.
That was beautiful. And that means a lot to me as well, because growing up, my family always used to go to James Taylor concerts together. We called it Home Fest, for lack of a better term. But that was phenomenal.
Well, I absolutely loved hearing you sing as well, because I know that you've done some opera singing and things of that nature. I had no idea you had such a beautiful lower register. That was wonderful.
Thank you. Well, I'm 64 years old, and my voice is getting a little older, lower as I get older. But it's okay. I mean, I sang alto when I was in high school, because you know what an alto is, right? It's a soprano who can read music.
I love that. I was an alto too.
See, you know. But I could sing soprano. But when I was in my early 30s, well, after I'd started doing law club shows, I thought, you know what? I don't have any decent vocal training. And I started taking voice lessons. And I went to a teacher who was really amazing. I was the only one of her students who wasn't a professional opera singer. And she had me singing very high arias. And at that time, I was hitting all the notes. Now, you know, at my age, it's pretty hard to hit some of those high notes, but I don't vocalize as often as I should, but I can sing alto and we should do something together.
You know, I used to always hate singing alto when I was growing up because it wasn't the fun part, right? It wasn't the melody and the pretty melody that you could sing. But as I've gotten older, I really have appreciated it because it's a lot easier for me to harmonize.
There you go. And you know how.
Make a song more interesting than exactly.
Right.
Than it is just singing the melody. So.
Yes.
Speaking of notes, tell us what some of the high notes have been throughout your career.
Wow. Well, the highest career high note, great segue, by the way, has to be being on the Colorado Court of Appeals. That has been the biggest professional privilege of my life. It's really been wonderful. I've enjoyed it so much. My colleagues are amazing. We get some easy cases, but we get an extraordinary number of very difficult cases that require a lot of work to prepare and read the background materials and figure out what the right decision is, and also writing them up in a way that makes sense and is legally correct is a real challenge. So that's just been incredibly fun. My colleagues are so wonderful, so smart, and deciding cases with two other really smart judges is such a privilege. When you get to a certain level in your practice, you often don't work with people who are at your peer level anymore. You may work with associates or, but generally you're not working with someone who's really as engaged as you are on the same level and with the same commitment. And boy, that's such a joy on the Court of Appeals because we really do have extremely intelligent people who have extremely committed to trying to get the right outcome and the right analysis. So that's been really fun. The other thing that I've gotten to do at the Court of Appeals that's been amazing is several years ago, I was designated to be the trainer for newly appointed judges on the Court of Appeals. It is such a hard job to do and to learn because nobody has practiced in all of the practice areas that come in front of the Court of Appeals. And so you're constantly learning about new areas that you didn't know about, and you have no idea how to do this job. So we talk about drinking from the fire hose, and I inherited a great training program from my predecessor, who had become the chief judge, Alan Loeb. He did a great job. I expanded the program, and during the course of my being the trainer, I've trained 13 of the judges on the Court of Appeals. And that has been such a privilege, because I'm a built-in mentor for them, and they need someone that they can come to when they just feel overwhelmed or they just don't know what to do, or just to ask any sort of a question. It's really been very rewarding.
How do you go about training these new judges on the Court of Appeals?
Well, I inherited some good outlines from Judge Loeb and some good advice from him, but this won't surprise you, I don't think, Courtney. I make really good outlines for teaching. And, you know, what I did was I thought about what do I wish someone had told me when I was a brand new judge? And that's what I taught people. And as far as I know, we're the only appellate court in the United States that has this depth of a training program for judges in inside the court. I mean, there's some other appellate seminars you can go to, and we send all of our Colorado Court of Appeals judges and Supreme Court justices to appellate judges school at NYU, the Opperman Institute, I believe is what it's called. But that is more of a generic sort of a learning experience. A lot of federal judges and state court judges from around the United States go to that. But my training, the training that I and my predecessors have done, is really specific to the way that we do things in Colorado.
So I have a couple of questions, because you mentioned that you try to think about things that you wish you would have known when you were first a Colorado Court of Appeals judge, when you're creating more or less some helpful tips, guidelines, training for new judges. So how long did you serve on the Colorado Court of Appeals? And how did that change over the course and scope of the time you were there with the things that you had learned, maybe getting to know the people better or the bench? Or how did things change over the years with the experience that you gained?
I am coming up on my 15th anniversary with the court. Such a privilege. And when I came on the court with my two colleagues, Steve Bernard and Jerry Jones, we all came on at the same time. We were part of a three-judge expansion of the court. Judge Sandy Rothenberg was our trainer, and she did a wonderful job. But because the job is so huge and it takes so long to really get a grasp on it, there was a lot that I didn't know, and I didn't even know what I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until I had been on the court for several years that I sort of figured out what I didn't know. And honestly, all praise to Judge Sandy Rothenberg. She's phenomenal. She did a wonderful job of training us. And to Judge Loeb, who preceded me. Fantastic job of training people. But I had a lot of years to think about what people really needed, what additional things, in addition to the training that they were getting, that they needed to know. And for example, how to manage your chambers, how to run it, how to manage the docket, how to run things so that you're reading all the briefs you need and getting all of the opinions in the pipeline at the times you need them to do it. And one of the things that I realized was that there are many different ways that the judges on our court manage those things. And so I did a roundtable where several different judges gave advice on how they do things, and then the new judge could pick and choose and change and try up new things. So I did one on writing judicial opinions because so many of our judges have been tremendously good writers. And it is really an art to writing a good judicial opinion that makes the parties and their lawyers feel satisfied that they've been heard, but also stands as good precedent that people can apply and use and is useful to the trial court judges and to everybody going forward, because our cases are precedential as long as they meet the publication criteria when they're so-called published, and all of the trial judges across Colorado are required to apply them. That's a big ask for us to make sure that we're writing up our opinions in a way that makes sense and that people can follow. So,
Judge Terry, I know that you have a very specific way that you like to write your opinions.
For published opinions, yes, that's true. One of the things that I find frustrating about the way the press reports on judicial decisions is that they only report who are the winners and who are the losers. They never bother to explain why the judge or judges reached their opinion. And sometimes the judges reach their opinion a certain way because they had to. They didn't have any leeway. The statute says X, or a Supreme Court opinion says Y, and you can't diverge from those things. So one of the things that I realized I needed to do, especially in some controversial cases, was in a published opinion, I try to get the why we're deciding a certain way on the front page of the opinion, if I possibly can, so that maybe the press will report that. It would be a nice thing. And maybe the public could understand and the bar could understand why we're constrained to find it this way, even if it's not the way people would like to see it.
You mentioned that you can't know everything when you get on the Court of Appeals. What was your practice before you went on to the Court of Appeals, and what was your pathway to getting to the Court of Appeals?
When I first started out as a lawyer, I did nothing but environmental law, and that is what I went to law school to do. After practicing it for a couple of years, I realized I wasn't enjoying it all that much, and my friends in the litigation department seemed a lot happier than I was. So I switched over to doing business litigation, and I did a wide variety of commercial litigation, which was really fun. So I did a lot of real estate related litigation, environmental litigation, insurance coverage litigation, intellectual property.
So you were working in this litigation with real estate litigation, environmental litigation. Did you have ideas that you wanted to be on the Court of Appeals?
Here's how the Court of Appeals came about. I had no idea I wanted to be on the Court of Appeals. I had thought about being a trial court judge. I had clerked for a trial court judge when I was right out of law school, but I didn't see myself being a trial court judge. I loved being on the side of the bench where I was trying cases, and I thought, I will go crazy if I am the person sitting behind the bench who can't say anything and can't try the case. And I've been an instructor for NITA for a really long time, the National Institute for Trial Advocacy. And seeing people try cases badly and not being able to go over and say, stop that, do this, because you'd be so much better, that would drive me nuts. So I really didn't think about anything beyond that. But a wonderful lawyer named Joanne Vogt, with whom I had worked very closely in private practice, even though we were in different firms, she had become a judge on the Colorado Court of Appeals. And she tapped me on the shoulder after she'd been doing the job for a few years. And she said, there's an opening coming up on the Court of Appeals and I'd want you to apply. And I almost fell out of my chair. I was so honored that she had said that to me. And it made me really think about it, and I decided I did want to apply. I thought the job would be fascinating. And so I did apply. I applied 4 times before I was appointed. I was nominated twice to the governor, and on the second nomination, I got it. So I have tried to return that favor by talking to people that I think really could be terrific judges on the Court of Appeals, and particularly people who have diverse backgrounds that I think may be lacking a little bit on the Court of Appeals and in the Colorado bench. So I have encouraged a lot of people to apply.
I do have a couple of questions, because you mentioned your practice areas, which did not include any type of appellate work. Did you have appellate experience before you applied for the Court of Appeals?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Yes, I did. And it wasn't the main focus of my practice, but I did do appellate work.
Did that create any uncertainty for you, or any insecurity when it came to applying for the Court of Appeals position? Did you feel like you needed more appellate practice or experience?
I thought that it might be a drawback in my application. And between the time that I initially applied and the time I was appointed, I did do additional appellate work. So I think my credentials improved in that regard. The thing about being a judge on the Court of Appeals is it's not really necessary to be an appellate specialist in order to become a judge on the Court of Appeals. You just have to be a person who can learn fast and well, because just the cases we get sometimes are so complicated and they're so diverse. If you think about all of those statutes in your statute books, you don't know what all of them say, right? And you probably haven't, I haven't yet run into anybody who admits to having read the entire Colorado Constitution, which is very, very long.
Oh, no. I've read the Constitution.
You've read the entire Colorado Constitution?
The rules change. Yeah, you can only have things that go for a year. It's very specific for the Colorado Constitution. But I have 2 questions with that. Because you mentioned you applied 4 times, and you mentioned that you made the finalist list twice. And so when you go up there and you're getting interviewed by the governor or the governor's team, and then you don't get selected, what does that feel like, and how do you bounce back to come back and then apply a second time, third time, fourth time?
It can be a sad experience to not be appointed. In my case, I really wasn't that surprised that I wasn't appointed, because I was pretty young at the time. And
well, let's talk specifically about the second time that you go up, right?
The second time I went up, I was very happy to be appointed. There were because there was it was part of a three-judge expansion of the court, they sent up 9 names. So I actually had a better chance that time. But frankly, it is a can be a very distracting process to be applying for a judgeship because you work very hard on it and you put a lot of effort into it. And people can become very discouraged if they're not appointed. My take on it is you can't have issues with rejection if you want this job. Very few people get it on the first try.
And as a judge, you need to be able to have that thick skin and not take things personally and move on. But when you mention that process, let's talk about that process when you're mentioning getting more people from different backgrounds on the Court of Appeals. Why is that important? And how do they go about taking the steps to get into that zone? It may not be something that's readily apparent, and they may not have somebody tapping them on the shoulder.
Someone asked me a few years ago, what do you think that people with diverse backgrounds add to the court? Why, do you think they have different takes on different things? I said, not necessarily. They don't necessarily have different takes on things. It's the representation that's important. The public has to see that the court looks like them. And if for a very, very, very long time, the courts in Colorado were all male, all white. And that took a long time to progress. And it's now making big strides, but it's been a long process. So I'm happy when people can look at our court and see someone that looks like them and feel that they, it's not necessarily their own voice that's being heard, but someone who kind of maybe knows what their experience is like is on our court. It's not going to make a difference necessarily in the outcome at all, but it's the representation that's important.
Have you seen the composition of the court change over your 15-year tenure?
Oh, yes.
What has been the benefit of that, or what's been different during those different times?
When I first came on the court, there were 4 women out of 19 judges, and then there was another woman appointed. There were 5 out of 19, and then two of the women retired at the exact same time, and there were only 3 out of 19. That was a strange experience. My colleagues, my male colleagues, were wonderful, fantastic people, but it is the representation. And so I spent a lot of time talking to the governors in the state of Colorado over the years, telling that story and what it feels like to feel so marginalized. And of course, we had very few people, we had very little racial diversity on the court. And I've been working on that since day one. So I'm so happy that we are as diverse now as we were. And in terms of sexual orientation also, we're diverse as well.
Is there any difference that you saw as far as how maybe you were addressed or treated versus maybe some of your male counterparts?
Occasionally, in oral argument, I would be ignored by counsel in preference to them speaking to some of the male judges. That has been a long time ago, though. That's really not something that persists, I don't think.
You mentioned when you were younger, you're a self-described loner. Tell me a little bit more. What does that mean?
I am really comfortable being alone for long periods of time, and that is actually really helpful in my job because I can spend enormous amounts of time reading and writing, and then when I get to actually see people and interact with them, I'm very happy to see them, but I don't get lonely.
So you are more introverted and maybe able to spend a lot more time without by yourself versus having other people around.
That's true. I am right on the border between introversion and extroversion. A lot of people would think that I am extremely extroverted. The people who have seen me perform, the people who've seen me on the bench, the people who've seen me do CLEs perhaps, especially teaching for National Institute for Trial Advocacy. I've taught a lot for them. Those people, I think, would think I'm very extroverted. But I am really comfortable spending enormous amounts of time alone, reading, writing, and
what has it meant to you being in the position that you've been in? Because you were a practicing attorney for how many years before you went on to the Colorado Court of Appeals?
I practiced for 22 years before I became a judge.
I thought this was going to be one of those stories where you said, oh, you know, I practiced for 5 years and then here I went. But so as that's gone forward and you've done all these things that seem to give back, you're training judges, you're doing National Institute of Trial Advocacy, you really have a mindset towards improvement and service. What do you see now that you're coming off the bench to put those things towards?
I want to spend some of my spare time giving back to the community. Hunger and poverty issues are extremely important to me. I used to be the chair of the board of Metro Caring, which is a nonprofit food bank that provides other basic services as well in Denver. I want to either reengage with them or with another organization that does what they do. And I also am thinking about maybe doing some tutoring for kids for reading, that sort of thing. But I am driven to do service. It's really important to me. I have signed up to do the senior judge program so that I can come and substitute for other judges when they go on vacation or if they get sick, that sort of thing. I'm not planning to do that right away, but it is such an incredible privilege to work on the Colorado Court of Appeals, and I love it so much that I want to continue to give to it.
Was that difficult for you, being so civic-minded that you couldn't be on these boards when you went onto the bench?
I thought the trade-off was worth it. And there's a lot you can do with your pocketbook when you're not able to do things in person.
I want to ask one question about where you get, I mean, you mentioned when you were younger that maybe you were assertive or bossy, but you have this real presence about you, Judge Terry, and a very just strong presence. What would you attribute that to? Did you have that naturally, or did you have things that you did to acquire that? And if so, what would you tell other young attorneys to do to develop that skill?
One of the things I would tell attorneys to do is to do a self-defense course, particularly for women. I think that's very important because it gives you a kind of confidence and lack of fear that allows you to jump in and do things you think you can't do. It was really helpful for me. And it also gave me power over people who were trying to scare me or overpower me, even if it was just in litigation, in a deposition, in some sort of a legal setting. It made me somewhat fearless, and that really helped my career and helped my life.
Give me an example of what kind of trash talk, I guess, you would have experienced during a deposition. I'm more akin to it for sports, but what would some of the people that you would use these skills with do that maybe you would set into this tool set?
I had a deposition one time where I was taking the deposition of an expert witness for the other side. And I asked a question in that deposition. And my technique, which I learned through Nita, was to never take my eyes off the witness and just have a really neutral tone and just have a conversation with the witness. I asked the witness a question, and the attorney for the other side not only objected, but he leapt to his feet and did sort of this really huge, like gorilla kind of like movement, and screaming at me at the top of his lungs, "You can't ask that question. That's an improper question." He's just yelling. I never broke eye contact with the witness. The witness was horrified. It was his witness. And the witness was on my side, really, because he was so upset about what this person was doing. I never changed my expression. I just kept looking at the witness. And when the guy was done doing his act, I said to the witness, "You can answer." And he did. So honestly, I don't think I would have been able to manage that if I hadn't had that sort of training.
Can you think of an improper question in a deposition? Isn't everything fair game at that point?
There are some improper questions, yes. But the thing about it is that there's no one to sustain your objection in deposition. I actually had opposing counsel one time make an objection and sustain his own objection during the deposition. And I said, that's really interesting. I don't think you can do that. So,
sounds like a fun person to be married to.
By the way, these were two different people in these two different depositions. Yeah, yeah.
So, and I would agree with Courtney too, because you do present in a very, you present in a confident, but certainly not an overbearing type of way. And you've talked about the self-defense class and how it kind of prepared you in responding to maybe aggressive situations or escalated situations in a more tempered and even manner. And I know that you talked a little bit about how that bled into your practice as well and kind of transferring those skills. Are there other classes or skills that really helped you kind of develop this professionalism, this even demeanor?
I would say that NITA, the National Institute for Trial Advocacy, really helped me in that respect. I got a lot of practice doing trials and trial skills and deposition skills, not just as a participant in the classes, but also as a NITA instructor and teaching other people how to do it. I think that was really key in developing some of my demeanor. And certainly when you're a judge on the bench, you are judged for your demeanor. And if you don't have an even keel, it can be really disastrous as a judge. So one of the things that I train the new judges on the Court of Appeals to do is to go back and watch some of their oral arguments, because they're all on video. And you see things that you didn't know you were doing. And you hear tones in your voice that you didn't. And I say, watch it with someone you love, because they'll be candid with you about what you need to stop doing. So I would like to think, after 15 years on the bench, that I have improved my demeanor to the point where I'm on an even keel and treat everyone with respect. And I hope I started out that way, but I suspect that I had to do some modification to make sure everyone felt heard and respected.
Well, I think I would go even a step further to describe your, it's not just your demeanor, it's your personality. It's very commanding of respect, but you're very approachable. You're not at an arm's length. You're very vulnerable in this discussion, but at the same time, you're very accessible.
It's really important when you're a judge to keep your everyday common humanity. The thing that people don't understand about judges is that we live in the same community as everybody else does. We're taking out the trash. We're cleaning up the dog poo. We're washing the dishes. We're taking care of kids. We're doing everything that everybody else is doing. And so while we have this very, very important job that I think rightly commands respect, we're just like you. And to the extent that that judges aren't just like you, that could really be a problem. We have to remain just like you in order to be able to do a fair job of judging cases.
Well, any other things you're going to do in your retirement, stepping off the bench, other than the tutoring? Are you going to do some things for yourself?
Some traveling, maybe?
Yes. When that feels really safe again, mm-hmm. We will continue to travel. We love to travel, my husband and I, and we've traveled to a lot of amazing places. We'd like to get back to scuba diving. We'd like to do a lot more bicycling and skiing. And those are the kinds of things that keep us refreshed. And making music. We really love doing that.
Well, Judge Terry, we're so thankful that you've taken the time with us today to share your very personal story and also all of the important work that you've done on the Court of Appeals and just your perspective. It has been so refreshing for us. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a joy. It's a privilege, really, to be able to do what I've done and to try to continue to make improvements.
And also, thank you to your husband, Greg Oberle, for accompanying you during that wonderful song. It was such a pleasure to hear you sing. So thank you both for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been Our Voices. For more information on today's guest or to get involved, please check out the CBA podcast page at cobar.org/podcast. That's cobar.org/podcast. This podcast series was created by members of the Colorado and Denver Bar Associations. Our Voices is a collaborative effort of the EDI Joint Steering Committee messaging team, including Mallory Revel, Linda Moss, Bonnie Schreiner, Mallory Hasbrook, Maureen Watson, Nicole Sparaza, Sumi Lee, Mario Trimble, Courtney Holm, and Emmy Lopez, with our CBA Communications Team Director, Heather Folker, and Manager, Charles McCarvey. Our recording engineer is Rick Pontellione of Lionsbridge Recording. Our producers and editors are Courtney Holm and Nicole Sparaza, with introduction by Mario Trimble. This podcast is made possible because of the support of the Colorado and Denver Bar Associations. On behalf of all of us, thanks for listening to Our Voices.